a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. The Senate Ag and Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Good morning to the Internet listeners first, and for those of you in the audience, a reminder to turn your cell phones off. We have some new members for those of you in the audience that are here a lot and see some familiar faces, but we do have some new members, so welcome. Welcome to the BEST Committee, Senator Lucas and Senator Ewing and Otten and Amdahl. Welcome to the most enjoyable committee that you'll be a part of. At this time, I will ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Senators Ewing,
here.
Frerichs,
here.
Lucas,
here.
Amdahl,
here.
Otten,
here.
Roden,
here.
Valley,
here.
Rampelberg,
here.
Krebs,
here. Quorum is present. A reminder for Secretary Perner to sign in as the testifying today. We are on our agenda today. We do have a Department of Environmental and Natural Resources overview. That is the only item on the agenda today. I do know he has a handout, and I believe the committee members do have that in front of them. A reminder to the committee, please, if we can, maybe hold some questions until the end of Secretary Perner's overview, and then we can go back unless it's something that you just really want to and urgently have to ask him at that time. Otherwise, we can go back, make your notes, and we can grill him and drill him at that same time then afterwards. We have on Thursday, we do have a good agenda as well, but at this time I will just turn it over to Mr. Secretary, Secretary of Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, Mr. Steve Perner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Perner, Secretary of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. I do have a couple staff members here that may help me answer a couple questions that I would like to introduce to the committee. We have just two divisions in the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. We've got the division of what we call the Technical and Financial Assistance. Dave Templeton is the director of that particular division. And the second division is the regulatory side of our house, the Division of Environmental Services. Tim Talsrode is the director of that division. Also here is Joe Nananichek. He's our staff attorney, and he spends a considerable amount of time over here. So if you have questions or need something from DNR, he's a good person to latch onto, and he'll try to get you what you need. As the chair said, we have prepared a handout to go kind of walk through for the committee. This handout will attempt to kind of touch on some of the things that have gone on during the last year and maybe give you a snapshot of some of the issues that we see coming up in the upcoming year. On page 2 of that handout, you know, I think it's important for the committee to hear what we tell, especially our new employees, really all our employees, but we emphasize it to the new ones during their orientation and so on. DNR makes a difference, we believe, by number one, protecting public health and the environment. Number two, we're a regulatory agency, but we work very hard to maintain a business-friendly climate. And probably most importantly, number three, we want to treat everyone as our customer, because they certainly are. With those points in mind of the way the department tries to operate, I thought I would touch on five top priority areas for the department, and kind of these are the big umbrella things, and then we'll kind of focus in on a few of the details. On page 3, one of our top priority areas is being frugal. Governor Dugard has instructed all of his agencies to try to live by that model. For our budget request for 2014, we actually appeared in front of appropriations last week already, but you'll all be voting on the general bill at the end of session, and you should know what DENR's portion of that bill is. Our FY 2014 budget request is a no-growth budget. We're asking for no new FTE. We're asking for no increase in operating, no expansions. In fact, there's an overall net decrease of $100,000 in our operating of federal authority. That would be the last of the stimulus authority that was given to us by the legislature for those ARRA or stimulus dollars. So we're taking that out of our budget. You'll see there on the bar graph, if you look at our general fund budget in perspective, it's about a little over $5 million. But again, if you go back, it's almost $1 million less than the peak of our general fund budget was in 2009. And in fact is, if you go back 10 years, you'll see there are fewer general fund in our FY 2014 budget request than there was in our budget that was approved by the legislature 10 years ago. So we're definitely operating with doing more, but with less general funds. We're one of the smaller departments. We only make up 0.4% of the overall general fund budget. A couple of other budgetary notes. Under other savings and reimbursements, we were able to save over $6 million by issuing $76 million of refunding bonds for the Water State Revolving Funds. Some of you may know, we run the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. EPA requires a 20% match on those funds. What we do is we go out to the bond market to get that match. We were able to refund some of those bonds, and we saved $6 million back in May. On the National Double Dip Recovery Lawsuit, what this is we've joined with 18 other states. Back in the 60s and 70s, when these major oil companies owned a lot of the gas stations around, they would have a spill cleanup or a tank replacement deal. They would recover money not only from the state, in our case it's the State Petroleum Release Compensation Fund, but also from their own insurance company. So this legal action has been going on for quite some time. We were the first state in the nation to reach a settlement during October with Chevron just before Christmas. We got about $700,000 out of that deal. That will be deposited back into the Petroleum Release Compensation Fund. We're really excited about that because that's going to allow us to do more of these abandoned tank removals, get those old abandoned tanks out of the ground before they rust and that stuff leaks out into the groundwater and so on. And then finally, there's the Brome Superfund site. We talk about this issue every year with the committee because it is. It's a major issue to the state. It's a major liability to the state. EPA, just before Christmas, negotiated an $8 million settlement with Cypress, which was a potentially responsible party. They had done some work at that site before Brome actually permitted it, so they were a potentially responsible party, and with Homestake to the tune of about $420,000. That money is going to be added to our Brome bond. It'll basically double the Brome bond. You'll say, wow, that's a lot of money. Well, it is, but our liabilities still vastly exceed that amount. Right now, while EPA is doing the cleanup, we have to provide a 10% match to the cleanup funds. And then once EPA leaves, which is not going to be for many years yet, but at that point in time, under the state or federal Superfund law, the state is 100% liable for the long-term site maintenance and water treatment of that acid mine drainage on that site, which will basically have to go on forever. But anyway, what we're trying to do is establish the Brome bond as essentially a trust account to take care of those long-term liabilities. Those settlements that EPA made are certainly going to help us go a long ways in establishing that trust account. The second priority issue on page 4, protecting human health and the environment. We had a couple of issues that definitely could have been public health issues that came up. In Chamberlain, routine testing found high disinfectant levels in their treated water on March 30th to the point of being really kind of a hazard. We helped the city issue a do not drink advisory. We helped the city track down the source of that spill. It was actually a spill into their treated water system. Rural Water Association came in with their trailers, helped flush out the mains, and we were able to restore quality water before there were any public health impacts. The second case was in Aberdeen. On June 20th, again, routine testing found E. coli in the drinking water in Aberdeen. That's a fecal bacteria, so it's no longer, that was definitely a public health threat. It's not just an indicator organism like total coliform bacteria. E. coli is a fecal bacteria. Consequently, we issued a boil water order. And again, Rural Water came in, helped the city flush, hypochlorinate the lines. We got all the water restored back to being safe and a high quality before anyone got sick. So we're very, very pleased with the outcome of both of those public health incidents. Another incident that I'll talk a little bit about was the New Store pipeline. Had a pipe burst. They lost about 20,000 gallons of diesel north of Aberdeen. The reason I bring this up is because, you know, this legislature has talked a lot about TransCanada and potential spills and potential leaks. In this particular case, the response by NuStar was an absolute model response. They came in, they shut that line down immediately. They were able to respond. It took several months to clean this up, mostly because we had very, very high groundwater in that area, and we had to wait for the groundwater to go down in the fall before they could get in there and get rid of the rest of the diesel. But the bottom line is, again, these types of situations can be handled. NuStar, in this case, was a model response. We really don't have any qualms about being able, the industry coming in and being able to handle incidents such as that. In May, we revoked a statewide reclamation bond for a sand and gravel outfit called VTS Rocks. It abandoned two mine pits totaling 29 acres. They had a $20,000 statewide bond, which is the maximum allowed by state law. I mention this because while we got the $20,000, that's certainly not enough to reclaim 29 acres. The bond amount, the maximum by law, is not enough. So what we'll do is we'll go in and reclaim as much as we can. But I simply bring that up for the committee's information. Protecting domestic use. We kind of got into a drought situation, as most of everyone here is aware, this last summer. So we had low flows in a number of our rivers. It got to low to the point where we had to protect domestic use. Domestic use is the highest use under our state water right law. That includes stock watering. So we had to shut off water right holders on Battle Creek, the Keapaha River, Whitewood Creek, and some on the Big Sioux River to make sure that domestic use was protected. That's never easy to do, but that's the law. The Big Sioux River fish kill. We had a fish kill right in downtown Sioux Falls in August. Of course, it had to happen on a Friday night. Of course, it was right below Morrell's. There was a lot of speculation about what was the deal. Was Morrell's causing this fish kill or not? So we spent over a week down there sampling, testing, and checking out Morrell's and so on. Well, we ultimately concluded it was really a combination of events. There was a low flow in the river, extremely low flow, very, very high temperatures, both in the air and in the water. And Morrell's did have a minor upset. Their ammonia levels in their effluent did spike, but not to the point of being an effluent violation. There were no violations. But really, when you put all three of those factors together, that's what resulted in that fish kill in the Big Sioux River. We reported on that to the public and through the media and basically put all the speculation that was going on down there to rest. And the final incident I'll talk about under protecting the environment was we had a dam on Bear Butte Creek, an illegal dam. This was during the motorcycle rally. There was a campground called Glencoe. They decided they wanted to dam up the creek and create a pond within the campground, I think to play volleyball around or something. I'm not sure what. But anyway, the downstream landowners, once the flow stopped, once they dammed it up and the flow stopped going downstream, some of the downstream landowners became rather upset. They had lost their flow for domestic use and stock watering. We issued an order to Glencoe Campground on July 27th to take the dam out. That didn't really produce any results. So we went to court on Sunday morning on August 5th. Part of the Deadwood deal is, or Sturgis deal, they run the court system there 7 days a week. So we took advantage of that. We got a court order Sunday morning to take the dam out. It still took them quite a while because it was a fairly substantial dam, as it turned out. But we did get the dam out and the flow restored. That's the protecting public health and the environment highlights. Under our third top priority area is building infrastructure to grow our economy. During FY 2012, we awarded nearly $100 million, $96.4 million in grants and EPA low-interest loans. Some of that money comes from the governor's omnibus bill, where you appropriate money through the Water and the Environment Fund every year. Some of that money comes from the EPA state revolving loan funds for clean water and for drinking water. So anyway, we were able to help out in over 100 different projects. A couple projects that I'll talk about that really do have some huge economic implications for the state. We were issued a $30.6 million loan to Brookings to upgrade their wastewater treatment plant. They had to do that regardless, but with the Bell Brands cheese plant moving in, it was even more imperative that they upgrade that plant. We were also able to include a $1 million consolidated grant for the Bell Brands wastewater pretreatment unit. But that's going to be a big project, huge economic implications, I think, for Brookings and really for the entire state. Another big project that has major economic implications, we awarded a $16 million loan to Ellsworth Development Authority to construct a regional wastewater treatment facility to serve both Ellsworth and Box Elder, and that's going to have, I think, benefits for years to come. And finally, the last project I'll talk about that highlight was the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System. You know, we've talked about Lewis and Clark for years and years. Finally, that plant was completed, went online this last fall. The dedication ceremony was in August. The timing was absolutely impeccable because as the Big Sioux River kept dropping and dropping and dropping, all of a sudden this plant came online and now is providing Sioux Falls and 10 other systems with a high-quality, reliable source of water. We still have the city of Madison, and then there's some other out-of-state members that are not hooked up yet. They're dependent upon future federal funding, but at least we've got the water treatment plant operating, and Sioux Falls is getting, again, a high-quality, reliable source of water. In November, the board adopted the 2013 state water plan. I'll simply mention that the governor's 2013 water omnibus bill that you see every year will be coming to you, and we'll once again closely follow the board's recommendations in the state water plan. Fourth top priority area I'll quickly touch on is growing our agricultural economy. That's always an important topic, I think, especially to this committee. You know, we've talked for several years about Longview Farms. This was a 4,900-head confined hog unit down by Wagner near Marty. It's owned by Iowa farmers. When they first built that, they said, we're going to build this. We want to put in a well. We're going to use less than the domestic use threshold of 18 gallons per minute. We said, well, if you're under the threshold, you're good to go. Go. Well, the Yankton Sioux tribe disagreed. They took that issue to circuit court and said that a confined hog unit is not domestic use, and the court agreed with them. And so they remanded that case back, and the Longview Farms did go through and get a water right. Meanwhile, the department brought legislation to the 2012 legislature, House Bill 1011, to clarify that a confined unit can be domestic use. And this came in front of this committee, and that ultimately was approved by the legislature. So now, again, a confined unit that's under the threshold of 18 gallons per minute can be a domestic use. Meanwhile, the Yankton Sioux Tribe appealed the water right permit that we issued to Longview Farms. Circuit Court ruled, this time in favor of DENR and the Board of Water Management. The time to appeal to the Supreme Court has passed, so Longview Farms has a water right and is good to go. And that, I simply bring that to tell you that some of these issues that seem to go on and on and on, they actually do end. That one's been put to bed. You know, there's also been talk about, with $8 a bushel corn, maybe our livestock industry is slowing down the growth and so on. And it might be, very well might be, but it's certainly not stopping. On page 7, I've included a list of confined hog units that we approved during 2012. Not all of these have been constructed yet, but they've been through our process. They basically fall under the permit, and they're good to begin construction or begin operation if they have constructed. So you can see that we still have some growth in our livestock industry, and in particular our hog industry. Another agricultural case that we've talked about for a number of years, that's the Veblen Dairies. These are over about 14,000 head dairies up in the northeast corner. We've come to this committee before and we've said they've had problems. They had financial problems. They had environmental problems. You can see, in fact, in the picture that, see that big pond? If you look down below, that's actually those four ponds. The water was high enough in their manure pond that it was overtopped the dikes. It was about that time they filed for bankruptcy. It was not a good situation at all. Environmental bankruptcy trustees took the operations over. We were able to work with the trustees to get those ponds drawn back down. There was no discharge. Everything was land applied the way it should have been. We finally transferred the permits to new owners. Their name of their new owners is Riverview LLP. I'm here to report to you that they've totally, from our perspective anyway, turned those dairies around. Their environmental compliance is top-notch. They've still got some paperwork issues to work through that we're working with them on their last inspection. But overall, we're very, very pleased with how they've turned that operation around environmentally, and I think they've also turned it around with the local residents and so on. They had an open house here this summer, had over 600 people attend. So, again, I think that's another issue that we've talked about for this committee a number of times, and I think that one we can put to bed as well. The final one I'll talk about under agricultural economy is the Hanson County Dairy. This was a proposed 7,000-head dairy. The Water Management Board approved their water right over local objections. There was considerable local objection to this particular dairy. The water right then was appealed to Circuit Court. And in this case, the Circuit Court said DNR and the Board of Water Management, you did not adequately quantify the recharge rate to the aquifer. Now, we thought it was pretty apparent that there was enough water available, unappropriated water available. The aquifer could certainly withstand this withdrawal, but the judge said he wanted it defined better. We spent a considerable amount of time trying to figure out how to do that. We got it done. We issued our report. We scheduled another hearing for September 18th and 19th. Meanwhile, the Circuit Court ruled on the county conditional use permit, and they ruled on August 16th that the county conditional use permit was no longer valid. Therefore, Hanson County Dairy withdrew its application for a water right on September 7th. That was before the hearing. Essentially, I think that issue has been put to bed as well. Some people may say it should have been built. Other people say it should not have been built. So depending on your point of view, anyway, it's done. It's done, depending on which. Okay, so that's our agricultural stuff. Let me switch gears on page 10 to our industrial economy. Last year we came to this committee and we showed you our new top-of-the-line fancy oil and gas database. It has information on it for nearly 100,000 holes. Some of the new features we've added to that interactive map. Now, as you can click on there and you can find the boundaries of all the oil and gas fields in South Dakota have been established by the board, and you can click again and you can find the enhanced recovery units that have been permitted by the board and are operational today. So there's some new stuff to that map. I encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't. A couple of comments we've gotten on the interactive map and all the databases that go with it. Brian Stambaugh with NMR Petrophysics emailed us to say, I wanted to say to whoever all is responsible for it, nice job on the GIS Explorer online. It is easy to use, easy to access. I think it'll encourage oil and gas in the state. Don Speaks, who is a consulting engineer for oil companies, was interviewed by KSFY and said, this deal in South Dakota really interests me. South Dakota is being very aggressive in trying to entice oil and gas. What the state is doing is offering oil companies a ton of geologic research free of charge through this online mapping database. I have never worked with a state that was so willing to help develop an oil industry like there in South Dakota. And you can see on the graph on the bottom, we're getting about 3,000 hits on that, or page views, I guess they call it, is the technical term, per month. So while we don't have the Bakken formation, we'll never even come close to being what North Dakota is. We are, again, putting out the information that we have on the resources that we do have, trying to encourage development in South Dakota. And to spread that word even more, on page 11 is just a sampling of some of the places that we visited during the last 12 months where we've given a presentation on this and what's available and how it can be useful to not just oil and gas, but really to anybody that's interested in what's under the ground. Derek Isles has been doing most of those presentations from our geologic survey. He's been definitely on the road the last 12 months or so. Another issue, industrial economy growing it that's been of a lot of interest to people across the state is the proposed Hyperion Energy Center in Union County. This is on page 12. You remember we issued that air quality permit first in 2009. It had an 18-month window for them to begin construction. They came to us nearly at the end of 18 months, said we aren't going to begin construction. We want to extend the permit. So we held another hearing, four-day hearing in September of 2011. The board issued the permit again with the extension. That was that air permit had already been appealed to circuit court, so the permit went back to circuit court for a decision on those appeals. On February 2012, Judge Mark Barnett issued a ruling that said, this court is unable to find any error in the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the BME. The issues presented by Sierra Club and Hyperion were all correctly addressed by the DNR in its various briefs to this court. Therefore, the decision of the BME, which is Board of Minerals and the Environment, is affirmed in its entirety. And so we were very, very pleased with that ruling. Basically, that meant we won everything. Of course, that court decision was appealed to the Supreme Court. There was oral arguments on October 3rd. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on that. Meanwhile, the new deadline to begin construction under that air quality permit is March of 2013. And, of course, Hyperion also let its land leases go, so the project seems to be in a state of flux at this point. But the next big milestone will be for the Supreme Court to issue its decision. And finally, on the industrial economy, we went on kind of a permitting binge last year, if you will. There seemed to be a lot of activity in the industrial sector. Back in January of 2012, the Board of Minerals and the Environment approved a 300-acre expansion for Wharf Gold Mine up near Lead and Deadwood. That expansion allowed them to save 150 high-paying mining jobs, and they plan to keep operating now for the next several years. Big Stone Power Plant near Millbank. We got our EPA to approve what's called our regional haze rules, which was actually a huge accomplishment. Those rules required Big Stone Power Plant, which is our largest coal-fired power plant in the state, to upgrade to meet those regional haze rules. That's a $400 million upgrade. That's going to be a huge project, and they're underway trying to meet the new regional haze requirements. Bell Brands in Brookings, we talked a little bit about that already, $100 million cheese plant. They came to us and said, what do we need for air quality permits? We said, what do you got for emissions? They told us what they were going to have for emissions. We checked. We found they were under the thresholds. I said, you better double check. We double checked. They're still under the thresholds. So as they stand right now, they don't even need an air quality permit from us. We said, you're good to go. They were happy. We were happy. And they're under construction. John Morrell wanted to do a $250 million upgrade. We issued them an air quality permit for that upgrade in June. Unfortunately, the high grain prices have caused them now to step back and wait and see how the grain price deal affects them and so on before they proceed with construction. Same with Valero Ethanol. We permitted a $2.5 million expansion for them. We permitted a $66 million upgrade for GCC Dakota Cement Plant in Rapid City. We approved an exploration permit to an outfit called Mineral Mountain Resources. They're looking at an underground gold mine near Keystone. And then what's coming up? We have some stuff on our plate. PowerTech, uranium mine, they've submitted two water right applications. We've public noticed our recommendation for approval. 111 people have petitioned against that. We're scheduling a hearing in front of the Board of Water Management probably for the later part of March. We've also recommended approval of their groundwater discharge plan. That's still out for public comment. We're still working on their mine permit. Meanwhile, they continue working on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission license and the underground injection control permits from EPA. So that project seems to keep moving forward. And finally, another controversial project is Valentine Mining Company is looking at doing some opening up what's called their Deadwood Standard Gold Mine. It would be on top of the Spearfish Canyon, pretty much above Savoy, if you know where that's at. Fair amount of controversy, but they're again working on a large-scale mine permit application that probably could come to us maybe next fall. And with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, on the last few pages, I've simply included a few of our performance indicators. You'll see that our workloads continue to increase. On page 14, you can see the hazardous waste generators continue to increase, spill sites continue to increase, grants and loans, water rights, which I might mention on water rights, there we've just seen a dramatic increase in applications with the drought. It's like we doubled the amount of permits we issued last year. The trend's continuing to go up. This is going to be a real challenge for us to figure out a way to keep on top of all the applications that are coming in. Air quality permits continue to go up. People under regulated drinking water systems. And then the final few charts are the outcome. You say, well, with all this growth, with all this new stuff you're talking about, what about the environmental standards? Are we maintaining the environmental standards here in South Dakota? On page 17, you'll see a few graphs that compare how we're doing in terms of our water quality standards, surface water quality standards. You can see a high percentage of our samples continue to meet those standards on a consistent basis. We're talking about fecal coliform and total suspended solids on page 17. On air quality, on page 18, you'll see it talks about PM10 and PM2.5. PM stands for particulate matter. The 10 is the big dust. The 2.5 is the little dust. You can see where the federal standard is. That red line across the top, we're well below the federal thresholds or the federal standards. On page 19, you'll see ozone. We're closer to that. What concerns us about ozone, we're still meeting it, but EPA keeps threatening to lower the standard, which would be a bad thing for us. So with that, I would summarize and conclude with this. Our legislative agenda for 2013, bills that you'll see from DENR, there's only three of them. We got Governor Dugard's 2013 Omnibus Water Funding Bill. That has not been introduced yet, but that'll go to appropriations when it is. Senate Bill 59, which is to prohibit the disposal of certain oil and gas field waste. That will, I think, come to this committee. Really what we're trying to do is put in place the same standards or prohibitions that North Dakota has, and trying to level the playing field on disposal of those wastes. And then House Bill 1059, that's a 96-page bill. If you remember last year, we came in front of this committee with a repealer bill that was fairly substantial. The governor said, that's really, really good, but I want more under my red tape review. And so we've come up with 96 pages, 299 sections or portions thereof, and almost 28,700 words that would be repealed from the code and our rules should you see fit to pass that particular bill. With that, Madam Chair, I will conclude and stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. At this time, I'll open the question process up to the committee. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Secretary Perner? Senator Frerichs.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to you, Secretary Perner. Good to have you here. I wonder if it's a privilege to be the first cabinet secretary or not in front of our committee, but it's good to have you here. On the water rights, I definitely heard from a number of not only neighbors and folks in the farm community who did express some frustration on the amount of time it takes to receive feedback on their irrigation permit. Anything that can be done to move that along that you would suggest that we look at, I guess I would welcome. I know when you gave your statistics at the beginning as far as your budget that you kept things pretty much stagnant from last year as far as no growth there. But, and I know we're not appropriations committee looking at the true FTE side of things, but I guess I would welcome any more input you would have on that, because we will have more questions from folks as they pursue. I mean, it's obviously a significant investment, maybe $100,000 that these folks will decide. And this year it was something where someone wanted to get it in last year's business and just couldn't get the final okay.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Secretary.
I mean, it's definitely been a challenge because it's just, I mean, the number of applications have just skyrocketed on us. What we have done is we've fully staffed the water rights program. We still weren't keeping up, and so what we've done now is Tim Talsrud, that's under his division, has taken a new hire that was supposed to go to a different program and said, well, until we get this under control and totally caught up, we're going to have that new person now learn how to do water right applications as well. So I think what we're going to do is, you know, just depending on how it goes, I mean, we're going to move resources internally to make sure that we can address that. Our job is to try to get the application recommendation done in about 60 days or so. Then, of course, there's a public notice. If it's not contested, we can issue that permit immediately after the public notice. If it is contested, of course, then we have to schedule a hearing in front of the Board of Water Management, which adds to the timeline. But our job is, I think what we're going to do is keep watching that very closely. If we can keep up, fine, with the resources that we've directed towards it now, and if we aren't, we're going to have to find more resources internally to redirect.
Follow-up, Senator? Further questions from the committee? Senator Valley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As always, good to have you back before the committee. Quick question on the, I got a couple of them, but this one stuck out a little bit, was the abandoned gravel pits. And who's responsible for the reclamation of that? If not, does the county, who watches over that? I have some land that not too far from there, there's some land that obviously was mined for gravel pits and never really put back the way it should have been. And I remember a county commissioner or someone saying, yeah, we should get after that. And I'm just, who has that responsibility? Is the bond enough? Should we be looking at increasing that bond? And is the bond, you know, does it make any difference if I've got 10 acres or 300 acres or how big my gravel pit is? Could you kind of go through that process and help us understand that better?
Madam Chair, first of all, if it was an old pit, it probably was before law, before there was any reclamation law. And so at that time, it was totally unregulated. At that time, it would have been up to between the operator and the landowner. The laws came in, and I'm thinking about 1983 or something like that, thereabouts, maybe. What the bonding requirement is right now for sand and gravel is $500 per acre, or what we call a $20,000 statewide bond. Those are the maximums set by state law. Are those amounts adequate? Probably not. Probably, if you were going to bond on a per-acre basis, it'd probably be closer to $5,000 an acre. The $20,000 statewide bond is definitely probably not adequate. So then you're going to ask, well, why haven't you proposed raising that? Well, you know, with the sand and gravel business, there's a lot of small operators. Just a lot of small operators. And right now, a lot of those guys really have a tough time making the $500 or the $20,000 statewide bond. If we were to propose raising that, let's say not even to the $5,000, let's just say double it or triple it or something, there's just going to be, I think you're going to put a lot of those guys out of business. And so then you have to ask yourself, well, in this case, like we just talked about here, where we got $20,000 and 29 acres impacted, what's the environmental harm that's going to be done? Now, you know, on one hand, the landowner isn't going to get the land probably put back the way he wants it. But on the other hand, it's not like my Brome gold mine where if we walk away from that, we've got acid mine drainage going into the creek. Instead, we've got some unproductive land. We've got maybe some dust issues, maybe some weed issues. But again, it's not the environmental catastrophe that I've got from where I've got a site that's really polluting something like with acid mine drainage. And so the issue of raising the bond has been talked about in previous sessions. We talked about it during a summer study, oh, I'm going to say 5 to 10 years ago even. I guess what's been concluded is at this point in time, we're hoping that there's enough good operators out there that'll reclaim the land the way they're supposed to, get their bond back instead of abandoning these sites, leaving us the bond, and then leaving us trying to clean up what we can with the amount limited funds we have. It's a balancing act. At this point in time, we've left the balance right where it's at and haven't proposed changing that.
Second question.
If I default and leave the bond to the state or whoever, and then I apply later, is that a automatic denial? I mean, can I screw up and then 2 years later find another place where there's sand and gravel and decide to go in there?
We would definitely take that into consideration. It would not, I don't know if it'd be an automatic denial, but it would certainly be part of the licensing. These are called a license that we issue. Be definitely part of the licensing discussion. I should say that I think, I don't know if, I guess I can't say whether anybody has done what you said or not. I don't, not that I'm really aware of, but maybe there has been, I don't know. But it would definitely be part of what we would be looking at.
Further question?
I have one other. Regarding the mining in the Deadwood area, I think that's adjacent to Terry Peak, if I'm as you're coming down that winding road, is that the one we're talking about? And how did that set with the people out there?
Are you talking about the expansion for Wharf?
Yes.
Yeah, that's close to the bottom of Terry Peak there. In fact, is some of that property was actually reclaimed. It was the old, what was the name of that mine? Golden Reward Mine. Wharf owned that property now. They actually have reclaimed some of that Golden Reward property. Now that the price of gold has gone up pretty good, they've taken another look at that. There's some low-grade stuff in there that they think they can go back and actually mine what's that previously been reclaimed make it economically feasible. Wharf is a part owner in the ski lift property. I mean, they're well aware of the issues associated with the skiing and so on like that, and they're actually working the ski lift issues into their final reclamation plan for this new property. The permit was, that expansion was contested. I think there was two parties that participated in the hearing. It was a good hearing, and I think the issues were resolved. I won't say to everybody's satisfaction, but at least we're fleshed out in front of the board. There was also a cemetery issue involved. The cemetery stayed put. Wharf said they would not mine the cemetery. So all in all, they had a good hearing, and again, the issues were all discussed in front of the board.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Roden?
Thank you. Secretary Perney, I was just curious, when you went through these some of these priority areas, the E. coli contamination in Aberdeen, what did they ever locate the source of that?
Madam Chair, they really never did. We kind of suspect that maybe it was related to some construction activity and maybe a cross connection or something, but they really never did nail it down. That's why we were concerned that once the lines were hypochlorinated, whether or not, you know, it would come back again. But the city really, I mean, they did a good, the city water treatment plant did a good job. They stayed on top of that. They closely monitored it. We didn't see a comeback. So whatever happened, they took care of when they went in there and hypochlorinated the lines.
Follow up. Further questions of the committee? Senator Lucas and then Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Perner, do we get any money from user fees that come into your budget for, like, used tires and oil? And how does that impact some of those cleanup projects?
Madam Chair, the money that comes into the Water and the Environment Fund, you know, there's dedicated water funding and dedicated solid waste funding. On the solid waste side, there's two sources of dedicated funding. There's a dollar per ton tipping fee of every ton that's dumped at a regional landfill. So we get a dollar of that that comes into the Water and the Environment Fund. And then there's a tire fee, 25 cents per tire, not to exceed a dollar per vehicle, that you pay when you register your vehicle. Those funds as well come into the Water and the Environment Fund. Both of those fees are considered solid waste fees, so then the revenues are appropriated out to solid waste projects, regional landfill projects, and recycling projects.
Follow-up?
Quite often I get tires changed in Nebraska at Valentine. They charge, I think, $2 a tire once you take them off your vehicle, unless you want to take them, which isn't any value to me. But have you considered upping some of those tire fees like that, that 25 cents is not much anymore? And, you know, those used tires do have some value, but they have to get shredded, obviously, and to get into the stream system. So that costs some money to do that.
Madam Chair, the even here, when you buy tires in South Dakota, you're probably going to pay at least a $2 disposal fee to the tire retailer. And he's using those dollars, hopefully, to properly, like you said, transport, shred, and dispose of those tires. So the 25 cents per tire fee isn't going... Some of that money, we work with regional landfills on a cost-share basis. Like we just did one here in, I think, Pier, where we cost-shared 50%. They advertise, bring us all your old waste tires. They bring them here, and then, again, they properly get rid of them, and we'll cost-share, like, up to 50% of that with that solid waste money. But, again, that money isn't going to just tires. I mean, tires is just one aspect. It's also going to these regional landfill projects, to other recycling projects, and so on.
Further question, Senator Rampelberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Perner, I just had actually two areas that I was kind of curious about. One, you know, I was on that summer study for oil and gas this year, and we heard testimony from a number of people as related to what you referred to, the $29,000 here, where what they had available just wasn't adequate. And I know Senator Adelstein has proposed a bill that would significantly increase the bonding amounts, and this is a broad waterfront right now, you lucky guy. Anyway, candidly, I don't have enough knowledge or background to really even know how to look at this. And I'm hoping that you or your people can maybe provide some information for people like me to understand what might be a proper amount that we should be looking at for bonding, because you're absolutely right. If we get too far out of hand, we're going to just shut down some of these economic and job development things that I think we really all want. But on the other hand, we need to have some level of assurances. But I would really appreciate your maybe making a note, so when those bills come up, if you could provide some testimony that would help me at least, I'd really, really appreciate that. Second area that also is Senator Adelstein's. You know, when we were looking at Barrick and the transfer to South Dakota, I'm saying, look, they got 270 miles of tunnel. So how in the world do they know where these tunnels go and who owns the land above them? And at the time, I was told that the surface rights only go 100 feet below, but I always thought they went down to the core of the earth. Anyway, but my question really is this. When we start talking about drilling for oil or gold or whatever it might be, mining for gold, do we have a mechanism right now that we can use to determine what where these either the drilling or the mining actually goes, so that we know whether these boundary surface rights or mineral rights are actually accurately followed or adhered to? And again, you don't have to answer that right now, but that's something when this other bill comes up, that's going to be another question, is how do we go about a survey or whatever it might be to determine, because I still can't figure out how we get 270 miles out of Barrick. But anyway, those are the two things that I'm looking for some help on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe if I just quickly respond on the bonding issue. Just remember, we're kind of talking apples and oranges there, because we've been talking about sand and gravel, where the maximums are set by statute. If you talk about a hard rock gold mine, for example, There, what the law says is we will bond for the cost of whatever it takes to fix it. And so there is no caps. Basically, we try to figure up a cost or whatever, and we take that to the Board of Minerals and the Environment and offer, we'll say, the bond in our the reclamation bond should be $3 million. These are the way we calculated it, and the board will take a look at that and decide whether we're high, low, or intermediate. Hopefully, we've worked with a company, and we're in agreement with those sets of figures. So I think what Senator Adelstein is talking about is more like in the gold mine case, where there isn't something set in statute. In terms of underground location, I think you're right. On underground gold mines, like Homestake was the one we had for 125 years plus, there really was no state control or anything about where they were doing all of those miles of adits and tunnels. That was pretty much up to Homestake. And as far as oil and gas, that's a little different because there we're doing spacing units, and there I think people are keep track a little bit more. But as far as underground gold mines, yeah, there isn't really much at the state level for exactly where they're at.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Rempelberg. Further questions? Senator Frerichs.
Thank you. And Secretary Perner, I did enjoy focusing on the Veblen Dairy success up there, and I do appreciate the work that your staff has done to keep that headed in the right direction. And I think those of us who are up there for the open house, I mean, I don't think you could have found a better day this summer where everything was green, and it you couldn't tell, I mean, from smell or anything else around there. Flies were the only ones that maybe came with us in the bus up there, it seemed like. I mean, it just was a very neat experience. But something that I've been talking to a few of the neighboring farmers in that area that have expressed some interest in being able to store manure for longer than 2 weeks or however, I think it's 14 days or something like that. Have you ever had any other requests or potential ideas on how we could make that a little more user-friendly? Because if folks want to maybe haul that manure to a particular location but maybe can't get it spread right away, but at least it'll be there for when things dry off in the spring or whatever it may be, that we could work with that. I did a little more checking, and it sounds like you probably don't strictly enforce it unless there's a complaint, I would guess, or something to that effect. But just curious if there's anything more you could shed light on what maybe we could work with that, or maybe it works fine the way it is.
Clarification, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, Madam Chair. You know, that has been an issue that I think has been discussed some. Obviously, when the manure is hauled to what we're going to call a intermediate storage site or interim kind of storage site, you're right, we're concerned about, okay, what happens if they get a 6-inch rain, and are there controls in there so it isn't going to run off into the Whetstone River and that kind of stuff. I think the way to address the issue that those your constituents are talking about is, you know, our general permit, water pollution control permit for concentrated animal feeding operations, has expired for a number of years, actually. And you say, well, why haven't you renewed it? Well, the reason we haven't renewed it is there's been a lot of federal changes at the federal level. There's been a lot of litigation. And what we've been trying to do is kind of wait and see until all this litigation concludes, let the dust settle, and see what the final federal requirements are. Because, quite frankly, there's one or two of those federal requirements that we aren't quite sure how to make work down here in South Dakota. So we've been kind of holding off, but we think the dust is pretty well settled. NRCS came out with a new nutrient standard here a while back that was really going to upset the way we had worked with NRCS and the nutrient management plan and that general permit. And so we went to NRCS, and we've worked with them to the point where we think we've got that unraveled and kind of put back into a user-friendly status. So anyway, the bottom line is I think we're getting ready now to finally renew that permit. And my suggestion would be if that's an issue that needs, that we should take another look at through this renewal process, this would be a good time to contact like Kentwood Manzie, Jeannie Goodman, some of our feedlot folks, and say, put this on your checklist, and when you're drafting, when you're renewing that permit, maybe this is something we would like you to take another look at again. And then once we come out with a public notice, people can contest it, and you go to hearing and all this and that. But to me, that's how you get it on our, and actually I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect it is already on our checklist to take a look at.
Follow up, Senator Frakes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Secretary Perner, for giving us a little more insight on that, because we sometimes either don't have a full connection to some type of federal permits that you folks may work on, and so it's nice for us to hear kind of the inside perspective on what you're thinking as we see some different federal regulations come down. On a similar related note, and I certainly will encourage those folks to work through that means, and visit with your staff. But what about as far as applying on frozen ground and or snow covered or some things like that? Because we still look at workability, and it'd be still better to get it spread out there than to have it piled up in yards. And as we know, cattle up to their bellies and you know what and things like that, it's better to get it out. So
that's been another issue that certainly has been raised. We've helped fund some research that's being done by SDSU to look at the snow covered ground issue. Of course, the way it stands right now is we prohibit the application of liquid manure on frozen ground. Solid manure can be done, but even then we kind of wince a little bit. But what we're trying to do is get some more information on really the impacts through that research, and that'll probably be an issue also touched upon during this renewal process.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Amdahl.
Madam Chair. Secretary Perney, I've got a question to ask you. How long does it take, and what is a permitting process for people that want to explore for oil or gas? What is involved in that for permitting?
Madam Chair, I think we try to issue a drilling permit in 7 days.
Okay.
Yeah, 7 days. But and then if that test proves productive or something and you want to do more, then you have to come in for a spacing order and all this other stuff that goes along with it. But your initial drilling permit, 7 days.
Okay.
Further questions of the committee?
I got one more question. What I understand we've got producing oil wells in South Dakota, is that correct?
Correct.
What is the process of monitoring those right now? Are you involved in that for making sure they're meeting the standards? Or,
Madam Chair, yes, the majority of our production, as it stands right now today, is up in Harding County. The producing formation up there is what's called the Red River Formation. We have a very few wells down in Fall River and Custer County. Those produce out of what's called the Minnelusa Formation. But again, the majority of the production is up in Harding County out of the Red River. The department does on-site inspections. We also have probably permitting actions like spacing orders or field orders or something that come in front of the board almost on a monthly basis. That has been a very, very high priority for the department simply because about 2 years ago, we started this thing, the oil and gas initiative that I talked a little bit about in the presentation, and assembling all that information in one spot and putting it all on the internet. Oil and gas, the department has had that as a very high priority for the last 2 to 3 years. And we don't have the oil resources. We don't have the Bakken formation that North Dakota does. But I don't see where the priority for oil and gas in South Dakota is going to go down off of our priority list very far.
Further questions of the committee? All right, just a few to wrap up here, Secretary Perner. I just wanted to clarify. I do encourage all of our members, for those of us that are back in our seats this year, had the privilege of your department clarifying the oil and gas website where you can see the water drilling, the wells, the oil wells. I would encourage the new members, Senator Lucas and Ewing and Auten and Amdahl, to go to that site. It's very interactive. That's what he was talking about. Can you give that to us real quick?
You just go to DNR's homepage, mm-hmm. and it's right on the homepage. You just click on that map that's on there.
Go to the state website and then go under the Department of Environmental Natural Resources, and you'll see the oil. I would highly recommend that. It's very interactive, very informative. You can drill down to see who actually owns each well, how far they've drilled, who the parent company is, how long it's been active, the date they were permitted. What else am I missing?
Well, for the oil and gas, there's 1,900 oil and gas holes. They're the entire file.
You'll see
some
the entire file.
Some of those files are hundreds, a couple hundred pages long. It's right there off of that. You just click on the dot, and there's a little drop-down box that comes, and it says file or whatever, and you click on that, and it's all right there. There's also the
water.
You
wells.
Mentioned the, there's about 30-some thousand test holes that have been drilled. All the logs are on there. There's over, 60-some thousand water wells. And you click on one of them, and again, you get the driller's log. So all that information is right there. Just click, click, click on each of those dots.
So, again, a recommendation to the committee members. And if you had further questions, please have his staff share with you how to drill down, because it sometimes is a little difficult at first, but you actually click on the actual, you can see the map there on that page. Excuse me, I'll get to it here. Page 10 of our presentation today, that's actually the little dots that you'll see where the wells are drilled, and on the record of that. And you click on each of those dots, you can further drill down, so to speak, on more information on that. So I want you to take that time, because I think everybody has questions. I think it's spurring from our constituents. You know, are we doing the research? Is there opportunity? And, of course, making sure that you're reading and following up on the summer study from the Oil and Gas Review, and you'll see that legislation come through, but there is an overview on that study as well. The last thing I just want to clarify, or a few things clarified, the tire fees that you talked about, that the stores or these retail outlets that are charging, that is not going into the state fund. That is a personal fund that they are charging us as the customer to help alleviate their costs of having to get the tires removed from their locations. So a disposal company will come in and buy that. They're charging us. They're passing along the costs, as we all know and incur in many other ways. So I just want to further clarify that. One question I had is, how often, this is probably a good thing just to hear in the committee, how often are you actually testing the domestic drinking water sites? So when you talk about Aberdeen situation, the Chamberlain situation, how often are you testing these domestic city water wells?
Madam Chair, it depends on the population. It's a population-driven threshold that's set by the feds and under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So a large city is probably sampling probably daily. A small community might be once a month.
Good clarification. And then last but not least, Secretary, the water rights and permitting processes. Is there something of an overview that you could provide for, again, all of us to refresh our memories for those of us that are here, but to further enlighten our new members on the water rights and permitting laws and statutes? I know I don't know what code, what title is that under?
Oh, it's either 45 or 46.
Okay, Title 45 or 46. But is there an overview anywhere that you could probably give us? Because I think some of those are questions that we're asking about bonding and the process and the hearings and things like that. I think that would be a good...
The best place for water rights is what we developed, I think, last year. It was what we call a water rights primer.
Yes.
If you get the pun there, prime the pump, primer.
I got it.
The guy that wrote this is really proud of that pun. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's a good one.
But anyway, if you go to our...
Dry humor.
Yeah. If you go to our homepage, there's a box in the upper left-hand side that says highlights. And I'm pretty sure it's still in that highlights box. It says water right primer. You click on that, and it's a little brochure that we've put together. And I can also bring hard copies to the some committee meeting to hand out as well.
But I would enjoy that. So please do share that. Again, did you hear, folks, where you can go on the site for that as well? I think that's it, Secretary Perner. We appreciate your time and always an enlightening information that you share with us and for our committee.
Well, very good. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And if you have any questions that come up anytime during the session that might be in our area, please feel free to give any of us a holler, and we'll do our best to try to get you the
information.
Thank you
to your staff as well. At this time, I believe that there's no other items on today's agenda, but just an overview what we have coming up. On Thursday, we have a full day. We have the Department of Ag overview. That'll be about 30 minutes. Then we'll talk a little bit about mountain pine beetles, so an update on the costs and where they're at and how many trees they've gotten taken care of and where they need and what kind of funding they need moving forward. And then last on the agenda item, two things, Power Tech, uranium update. And then there'll be one bill that will take up, Senate Bill 40, an act to require certain receipts of delivery to grain elevators to be kept and to establish certain penalties for overweight vehicles and trailers. So that will be just quickly addressed. On Tuesday, the following Tuesday, 1 week from today, we have Game, Fish, and Parks overview so that we have all departments reporting and sharing the information to you. And we do have six other bills on the calendar, and I will be calendaring them at the time. We won't take them all up, but we'll be putting them in groups of the brand board billing bills as well as Department Ag bills. Separate, and then oil and gas won't come through. I believe that's coming through or going through the Commerce Committee. Any other agenda items that you'd like to discuss?
Just a question, Madam Chair. As far as our books, there were a number. Will we have our books the day ahead of time?
Have our secretary clear for
all of them, all to have books. Or
I think our committee preference would be to have our black books in our hands the day before our committee hearing so that we can review the bills before. Is that all right, committees? And I think
I don't mean right.
And like you can see, I believe the pages know who's paperless and wireless and whatnot. So either you're paperless, wireless, or paper full. So, all righty. At this time, I'll ask for a motion to adjourn.
So
moved by Senator Roden, seconded by Senator Frerichs. All those in favor of adjournment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Senate Ag is so...